right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and our show today is, it's a powerhouse. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Jim Cavallaro from Stanford and one of the authors of an important study called Living Under Drones. Now, this study is especially important, and this conversation is especially important, given how drone warfare has become the choice of warfare for the U.S. in many parts of the world, especially around Pakistan, Afghanistan, and some few other places in that region. All right. And it's just outright blatant, terrible murder. And it's what's been embraced by Barack Obama and all of his gangsters. And it gives you a clear idea of what this system is all about and why it's just no damn good. All right. So don't miss that segment of the show. But opening the show up, I'm very happy to be getting back into the interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, I did a 5-part interview a little while ago. This is part 3. And in this part of the interview, Avakian is talking about, where are the forces who are going to make this revolution? Where are they going to come from? So without any further ado, let's just jump right in to Bob Avakian being interviewed by me, Michael Slate. I was going back and forth on whether I was going to do this, and I really want to do it, and so we'll see what happens with this. Because exactly what you're saying in terms of this BA Everywhere campaign and all the stuff that you've been saying about the strategy and how we can get to this point where revolution isn't crazy but actually is seen as possible and is seen as something that people are taking up and fighting for in many different ways, there's a point that comes out of the forces to do this, that you actually do need to bring these people forward. And I know part of this campaign around the BA Everywhere is actually bringing forward cores of people who will do this, particularly among the people, you know, the people on the bottom of society who will be like the backbone of this revolution, but also among other sections of people as well. And I wanted to explore that, just if we can do it just briefly, even it'd be really good, I think, because this is one of the quotes that people from both the bottom of society as well as more middle class people really had to wrestle with. It really struck them, and I think it says something about when people talk about where are you going to get these forces in society. And this quote is, people say, you mean to tell me that these youth running around selling drugs and killing each other and caught up in all kinds of other stuff can be a backbone of the revolutionary state power in the future? Yes, but not as they are now and not without struggle. They weren't always selling drugs and killing each other and the rest of it, and they don't have to be into all that in the future. Ask yourself, how does it happen that you go from beautiful children to supposedly irredeemable monsters in a few years? It's because of the system and what it does to people, not because of unchanging and unchangeable human nature. And I think that really is something very important in relation to, where are these forces going to come from? They're going to come from the very people that oftentimes are condemned, you know, or demonized, as you've put it in other places, demonized, and as they're not only not fit to be, you know, rule, you know, part of ruling the future society, but they're not fit to be even walk on the streets today. You know, and I think this question of transformation in terms of these forces that will be brought forward to be part of this revolution.
Well, you know, I was thinking, I've said this before, that when I went into exile in France in the early 1980s, I met someone from Asia who was a revolutionary-minded person. And one of the first things they said to me was, what's happening with black people in America? What's happening to their struggle? It seems like the imperialists have been able to contain them and suppress them. So what's the deal there? It looks like they're not, you know, revolutionary the way they were just a few years ago, and that this has all been crushed. And I said, well, maybe maybe in the short run and for the time being, but don't be too sure about the longer term. Because and it's not just black people, but this is one of the most concentrated forms of the oppressive nature of this whole system from its very beginning and down to today, the way in which it is treated and oppress the masses of black people. And there are others in similar conditions, immigrants and forced into the margins and brutally exploited under the system, Latinos and others in the inner cities of the U.S. as well as people in other sections of society whose exploitation is increasing and whose conditions are becoming more difficult, or who are becoming in a broader sense aware of some of the workings of the system, for example, once again, with regard to the effect on the environment, and becoming concerned about that, as well as learning about some of the other ways in which this system creates all kinds of atrocities and enforces all kinds of suffering. But people have said, well, where do you think the forces are gonna, for example, when I did the interview with Cornel West that you referred to, he asked me at one point, whom do you see as being the sort of the basic driving force of this revolution? And I said, well, now, you know the answer to that, and I know the answer to that, and the ruling class of this country knows the answer to it, too. That's why they've got a war on drugs, which is a war on poor people, and why they've got this mass incarceration, other forms of degrading and oppressing people. And when we've gone out to people in these situations, precisely the kind of people that are spoken to in that quote from Basics that you just read, you know, the youth who have been caught up in crime and gangs and drugs and other things, or, you know, women who've been forced into all kinds of degrading conditions. When we've gone out to these people, you know, the basic message about revolution deeply resonates with a lot of people, but then they raise the same things that a lot of other people raise about the difficulties and how could we actually do this. And look what we're all caught up in. Even people who are caught up in this mess know that it's not good, know that it's not really what they want to be doing. And so they raise the question themselves, how can we break out of this? And this is a difficult contradiction because the conditions that people are caught up in, the fact that there are no decent jobs. I was talking to someone the other day and they said, look, you know, when I brought up the situation in Spain, we were talking about other countries and how the economic crisis hit them even worse. And the fact that, as I understand it, for people 25 and under in Spain today, the unemployment rate is 50%. And it's something like 30% for the whole society. Obviously, these are conditions that cry out for revolution. And they're one of the things that's lacking there and needs to be is a communist core that can actually lead this in a revolutionary direction. But as I was talking about this with this person, they brought up, yeah, well, that's, you know, that's very stark and terrible. But in many of the inner city communities, Black and Latino communities, the unemployment rate for the youth in particular is even higher than that. Sometimes it's 75 or 90%. So, you know, in these kind of conditions, and as I point out before, it is not these youth who have been forced into these conditions. It's not they who took the jobs away. It's not they who created the unemployment rates that we're talking about. It's not they who, for example, closed down the huge U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, which used to employ directly or indirectly tens of thousands of people, and have turned Gary into a ghost town with huge unemployment and drugs rampant and people suffering terribly, or you can look at Detroit and a similar kind of thing. It is not the people in those inner cities who are suffering in those conditions and responding to them. It is not they who created those conditions. And this is one of the things that, first of all, it's very important for people to understand. That's what that quote you read in other parts of Basics and our whole overall work, including through our newspaper, Revolution, as well as other works of mine, talks and writings, are bringing out. It's very important for people, including the people most directly caught up in and subjected to this, you know, to these conditions. It's very important for them to understand that this is not something of their own doing, because it's constantly preached to them, including by the, you know, Obama, as I referred to earlier, that it is their own fault, that it is their own personal responsibility. It's very important for them to understand, you know, not just an abstract sense that this is not their fault, but what are the actual workings of a system here that has put them in this position, and what is the actual real alternative to break out of this? You know, and I've used this example before. There are important things going on where people who have been condemned as the worst of the worst and, you know, thugs who are subhuman, who deserve, as you said, not even to be on the streets or not even to live in some people's eyes, let alone to be the backbone of a revolution and of a new revolutionary society. Very important things going on. For example, there have been the hunger strikes in California prisons, including people in the most desperate and difficult conditions in those prisons within the last year. And some of these hunger strikers have now made a very important call for peace among people of different races in the prisons. And this is a tremendously important thing and also a tremendously difficult thing that they're setting out to do up against very difficult odds and forces, not just the long-standing grievances that they have among themselves and that have been built up over all these years and decades of these rivalries, but also, and more importantly, the workings of the system and the ways in which, in the prisons and beyond, the authorities will try to undermine and break apart this unity and cause people to be back at each other's throats, because this is the way in which they can keep people in the conditions in which they're at, both in the prisons and out in the larger society. So this is a very important thing that people need to be aware of much more broadly, and people need to be supporting in many different ways. Or I use the example going back to the, you know, heroic rebellion in 1992 after the whole outrage of the cops who brutalized Rodney King and were caught on tape doing so, were acquitted, you know, that during and in the aftermath of that rebellion, from the first night where you saw the graffiti that, on the walls that said "Blacks and Mexicans together tonight," to the ways in which there were efforts to overcome the rivalries among the street gangs and to promote unity between people in different sets and people of different nationalities. There were attempts to have unity picnics, to have unity conferences, unity summits. There were real serious efforts made by a lot of the youth and others who'd been caught up in this to break out of it and do something different, reflecting an awareness on their own part that this is not the life they wanted, and this is not what their whole being, not what they wanted it to be about. This was not somehow some core of their being that could not change and that they did not want to change, but just the opposite. And these efforts were once again opposed and suppressed by the system. Time and again, unity picnics were attacked by the police and rivalries were fomented by the police and other authorities to try to break up this unity. But even more broadly and fundamentally, the program that these forces of unity came up with was calling for entrepreneurship and loans and ways in which people could get into more legitimate pursuits and businesses. And there just wasn't a basis for this within this system. And there wasn't a basis in which that could be viable. The system could not accommodate it. And so people were repressed. Their attempts were frustrated. And many people went back to doing what they've been doing before. But that doesn't mean this is what people want to be doing with their lives or the highest thing that they can aspire to and do aspire to. And that's why when we go out, this whole message of revolution resonates. And then we have to find the ways to break through. I mean, one of the things people may not be aware of is when we found very often that when we go out and take the message and the program of revolution to people and talk about fighting against, you know, mass incarceration, police brutality, blow the whistle on stop and frisk, as people did on September 13th, blow the whistle on police brutality, that many, many people, including, you know, all the way from the young 9 and 10 year old shorties to old people, you know, in the projects, are very actively supportive of this in many different ways. But we find this divide, and we've seen it again and again. We saw it in protests around the murder of Sean Bell in New York, for example, that often the young men, more than the young women, are hesitant to get involved because they're all already on probation or in some other way bound up in the so-called justice, in fact, really injustice system. And they know that if they step out, this will be used to revoke their probation or their parole or in other ways to repress them. This is a concrete chain on people that we have to find the ways to break through. It's very good that a lot of the young women are more ready to step forward. That's very good. But we also need to bring forward the young men, too, and the people broadly in the community. These are the things that we have to fight through in order to give expression to the desire that we have discovered, you know, more and more deeply is there for people to break through and have a different way. And the fact is that for the masses of these youth, and in fact for the masses of youth and people in the world, this system has no good future or alternative, but the revolution does. And we need to find the ways to work and organize people collectively to develop the community approaches and collective approaches to helping solve the problems and deal with the obstacles that keep people in these situations from getting actively involved in the revolution. But there's no question that there is tremendous potential there, and we have to keep working on the contradictions and on the obstacles and on the fetters that keep people from being able to give expression to their desire for a radically different world. Even as, yes, as it says in that statement you read, we have to struggle very intensely and even fiercely sometimes with people about what this is all about, that it's not just about revenge. We have to raise our sights to a whole different world and fight for a world not in which you can finally have a chance to get back at some other people. That just keeps the same thing going we've got now. You know, maybe people had a little bit better situation than you. The point of the revolution is not to, you know, be able to go after those people or even to get revenge on other people. But the point of it is to uproot and overturn this system and move forward together with people struggling for the same thing in all parts of the globe to get to a world where all of these things that chain people down and suffocate their better aspirations, no longer exist and no longer define the human condition and the life of the masses of people in the world. This is what this revolution is aiming for, and this we have to struggle to raise people's psyches, even as we find the ways to break through the obstacles so that they can begin to form what we might call a critical mass of people who are turning to this revolution. Small numbers at first who step forward in different communities, neighborhoods, workplaces, schools, and so on, who are out there very boldly for this revolution and constitute an actual attractive force that then begins to change the situation where nobody thinks it's possible, everybody doesn't want to be the first to step out, to where there is a group there that has a certain coherence and force as a revolutionary pole, fighting actively against the oppression and raising people's sights so that more people then gravitate, because it's not just an individual here and an individual there, but it's actual groups of growing numbers of people who are boldly stepping out. And yes, being the first ones to step out on the line and say, we're with this revolution, at the same time as we need to go broadly and all among all sections of the people, both the people immediately in the neighborhoods and schools that people step out in, but also broadly in society to say, and to have open and public manifestations and bold manifestations among people to say, we want our youth to fight for a better world. We are proud of our youth and others who step into this revolution, and we are with them and backing them.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you're listening today to an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And this interview digs into the deepest questions confronting all of us who look at the world and see what a horror it is and whose hearts ache for fundamental revolutionary change, all right, for a whole different world. This section of the interview is part three of five parts, and this section gets into where are the forces that would make this revolution, where are they going to come from? If you miss any part of this five-part interview, you can always access it at revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Yeah, and that brings me to, let's revisit briefly this point about the middle class, the liberals, the progressive middle class. Because, you know, it's true. What you're saying is definitely true, and including the fact that there's an important role that middle class people have to play, progressive middle class people have to play in a movement for revolution, you know, in a revolution itself. There's an importance in terms of, you know, how do they relate to this?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was thinking of some things that here in this city were told to me years ago about big movie stars who made a point of opening their house so that the Panthers could meet there free of police surveillance and harassment. You know, that there's these, and then other people who went out and actually created things and did things to change some of the fabric in society, some of the discourse, some of the atmosphere in society, which gave people room to breathe in a lot of ways, you know? And I was thinking about this situation we have right now, where we have this point that you've pointed out. And I know this is a very popular, I have a friend who made a t-shirt out of this, the point about the Oedipal complex that you made, that liberals have an Oedipal complex, not that they want to sleep with their mothers, but they willfully blind themselves. And I wanted to talk about that because that too is something that's extremely, I think, bound up with this whole question of transformation and what has to be done there.
Yeah, well, the point of that is if for those people who actually read Oedipus Rex, which I did as an English major many, many decades ago, that at the end of the drama, Oedipus actually does, you know, poke his own eyes out when he discovers the horrors of what he's been involved in. In fact, in sleeping with his own mother. But the point was that statement of mine that liberals have an Oedipal complex is the point about deliberately blinding themselves. You know, that it's not they want to sleep with their mothers, but it's they deliberately blind themselves to all the horrors that are going on and to the ways in which it can be recognized that they flow from this system. And, you know, this, you know, goes along with a statement that, you know, one of a comrade in our party made, which I think is very insightful and very incisive and gets to something important, when they said, well, you know, a lot of people who used to know better and you came out of the 60s, for example, and were very active and radical or even thought of themselves as revolutionaries, but have since, you know, become, you know, quote unquote wiser, but actually more foolish and more, you know, have actually settled into accommodating to the system, or other people in the middle class who don't like injustices that they do see, but who don't want to get out of their comfort zone to struggle against it, that for these people, this comrade said, the attack on revolution, the attack on communism, the attack on the Cultural Revolution, on Mao, you know, and all that has had the, you know, has provided the framework in which these people can say, with regard to fighting against the injustices and going up against the system that perpetrates and enforces these injustices, the attitude that, as his comrade put it, the way these people think is, I'm so glad that it turned out that the right thing to do about all this is to do nothing at all. And I think this does capture where a lot of people have retreated into, and it does have to do with this point of then at the same time, in order to remain in your comfort zone, willfully blinding yourself. But at the same time, you know, our whole approach is to build a broad united front, including people from the different sections of the middle class, to unite with them in ways in which, you know, whether it's the Occupy movement or which was involved others in the middle class, but was to a significant degree, you know, made up of people from the different sections of the middle class, or people who are moving around the environment, or people who do protest the torture and war. There are far too few, but there are some. Or other forms in which people do question, dissent, criticize, and even rebel or resist or protest. It's very important to unite with that among all sections of the people, including in the middle class, while at the same time we recognize that the core, the leading and driving force, this revolution, is not going to come out of the middle class, but it's going to come out of the people who most desperately need this revolution and have much less, if any, of a comfort zone to retreat into. So that's an important point there. Now, but the fact is that you are never going to have a revolution in which only the people who are most desperate are striving for that revolution. They have to have allies, and they have to have forces that they're able to unite with more broadly in society. More particularly, you're never going to have a revolution without a vibrant and increasingly radical student movement, which is going up against the injustices, including the unjust wars of the system, and in which is, you know, raising the big questions and debating the big questions, and which is developing a culture, as we say, a culture of radical revolt against this revolting culture that spews forth from and dominates, you know, in this society, spews forth from the system, reinforces it, and spreads its ugliness throughout the society as a whole in many different forms. So all these are very important elements of building a movement for revolution. And in more particularly, you do need people who are willing to, you know, who are in the intelligentsia, who, you know, people who do work with ideas, whose ideas can influence other people in a disproportionate way because they are concentrating thinking and spreading its influence out in society. You do need a section of the intelligentsia to, as it's been put, transfer its allegiance from the present system and the present ruling class to the cause of the oppressed and to the cause of revolution and of communism. And this, you know, is going to win over a section of the intelligentsia in today's conditions. This was a mass phenomenon, as you know, back in the 1960s. And, you know, I wouldn't even be sitting here talking about revolution and communism if this hadn't happened at that time through the influence of the Vietnamese people's struggle and black people's struggle in the U.S. and then how this in turn gave rise to a growing women's movement and a gay rights movement and liberation movement and so on and so forth. But this, under today's conditions, is being suffocated by what we've been talking about at various points today, which is the not only the changing conditions where there isn't out in the world a vibrant and inspiring alternative as there was when we came forward back in the 1960s in China and the Cultural Revolution, when that has been overthrown and reversed there in China, but also when there's been this relentless ideological assault and, as I put it, a campaign of ideological revenge against what was represented by China and the Cultural Revolution and against revolution and communism in general. So it's more difficult. And it's also, there's been this whole dumbing down of the society where the educational system has been increasingly geared not to developing people who think critically and challenge things, but just people who know how to take tests and try to prepare themselves to get a job in a world where it's increasingly hard to get a job and where students are burdened with tremendous debt. All these things are weighing on students and lowering their sights and people in the intelligentsia more broadly. But still we have, there is a basis, there is a potential, and we have to fight through to win in waves growing numbers of people among the intelligentsia who can contribute to the movement for revolution and contribute to the core of communist leadership that's needed for that revolution, both by helping to counter the slanders that are being heaped and the abuse and distortion that's being heaped on the experience of the communist revolution, but also to popularize the new synthesis of communism that's been brought forward and is embodied in my body of work. And beyond that, and at the same time, also helping to address and solve the theoretical and strategic problems of the revolution. Because we have developed a basic, in our party, a basic strategic approach to making revolution, yes, in this country, and actually to fighting through and winning when the time comes. But that is precisely that. It is a strategic conception and approach. There's a tremendous amount of work that has to be done to continually deal with and overcome the contradictions and obstacles that get posed in the way of actually building that movement for revolution and actually wielding and uniting all the different forces that have to be part of that revolution and enabling it to all go in the direction toward revolution where it needs to go. There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done to solve the problems, including as they arise in the realm of theory and strategy. It's like Lenin said, theory is extremely important, and we should never downgrade the importance of theory and of working with ideas, which is all too often done in this society with its sort of rank pragmatism and widespread philistinism. We should never downgrade the importance of theory and working with ideas and the intellectual ferment of all different kinds. You're never going to have a revolution without that, and the kind of revolution you could have, even if you could make a revolution without that kind of intellectual ferment and artistic creativity and so on, would not lead to anything really radically different and better. So we need that. But at the same time, as Lenin said, theory, as important as it is, he was actually quoting Goethe, if I'm not mistaken, the German poet Goethe. He said, taking that statement from Goethe, Lenin said, theory is gray, but green is the tree of life, which is a way not of saying that theory is not important and intellectual work and working with ideas and developing strategy, developing what we call line, that is, an outlook, a method, and its concrete application to develop program and strategy and tactics and policies to actually build the movement for revolution. All that kind of work in the realm of ideas and theory is very important, but life is always more complex than you anticipate. So there's continual work both to carry forward with enriching and developing the theory, but also to solve the practical problems that arise in carrying out the theory in line to actually deal with the greenery of life and the complexity of life and the struggle to change the world.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you've just been listening to part three of a five-part interview I conducted with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. This part dealt with the forces for revolution. Where are the people that are going to make this revolution? Where are they going to come from? We got two more parts in the series, and if you miss any part of this five-part interview, you can always access it at revcom.us. That's revcom.us, all right? So don't miss any of it. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Jim Cavallaro, the author of an important new study called Living Under Drones. And given how much Barack Obama has become associated with, in fact, one of the gods of drone warfare, this horrible murder and torture of people in various parts of the world, you don't want to miss this segment, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was The Slackers with International War Criminal, James Cavallaro. James is a professor of law, director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford University. And Jim is he was involved in this new report that came out at the end of September, and that report was called Living Under Drones. And the report was co-authored with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Your study was just a mind-pounding study. Anybody who's paid attention at what's going on in the world, and particularly in that region of the world, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that whole area of the world, the idea of this drone warfare, we hear it constantly, continuously, and some people are outraged, but really, generally, there's not enough outrage. And part of that, I think, comes from people looking at this as sort of a very clean, very surgical. This is sort of just the way that war is conducted today. And actually, it's a nicer war. There's not as many American boys being killed in a war like this. Your study kind of slams that all to hell and says the entire narrative around drone warfare is false. Tell our listeners what you're talking about there.
Well, to start, it's worth spending a bit of time on what the narrative has been. And I think you summarize it well. What I would add is the idea that has been dominant in mainstream media in the United States, and this is largely fostered by the official discourse, the main idea has been that drones and drone strikes are surgically precise, that the only casualties caused by drone strikes are terrorists. And since that has been the main narrative, naturally, it has served, among other things, to mute opposition to drones. We were very concerned by this narrative because information that we had and also others and organizations had approached us to see if we would be interested in investigating independently what the consequences of drones and drone strikes actually has been in Pakistan. And we took up that challenge and spent pretty much the year 2012 to date investigating intensely what have been the consequences of drones and drone strikes in Pakistan. And the result of our work is the report that you cited, Living Under Drones. But in a sentence, and of course I'm happy to get into much more detail on this, is the dominant narrative of surgically precise strikes that hit only terrorists is simply false. That, in fact, drones hit civilians, drones hit all sorts of buildings, and that drones have a significant impact on entire communities who are on a daily basis terrorized by these unmanned vehicles flying overhead that at any moment can fire down a Hellfire missile that can kill anyone who happens to be within the blast radius.
Let's jump into this one at a time here, because one of the things that you just said about supposedly the narrative being it doesn't hit civilians, you're arguing that, in fact, civilians are deeply impacted, in fact, killed by this drone warfare. And this is something that really, well, look, frankly, we're living in a situation where the U.S. government basically says it's in the single digits or there's virtually none, no civilians have been killed. Nobody in the U.S. regime actually admits to significant civilian murder as a result of this drone warfare. How do you speak to that?
Well, first, what's important, and there was an important piece written by Joe Becker and Scott Shane in late May in the New York Times, and that piece investigated the process by which drones are authorized, or at least some drone strikes, rather, and I can get into the details of what the focus of that piece was and should still be considered in more depth. But one of the very important revelations in that piece was that the administration counts those who were killed in a strike, if they are males of combatant age, which is quite a broad range. If a male in the relevant age range is killed in a drone strike, the administration considers that person to be a combatant unless there is posthumous evidence demonstrating that person's innocence. So think about that. Take a second. Wrap your head around that. What it means is if the United States fires a Hellfire missile from a drone and it kills some group of men, the United States considers that they're all militants. Well, of course, if that's your calculation method for establishing who is a militant or a combatant, of course your figures for non-militant or non-combatant deaths will be low. In fact, the presumption should be of innocence of those who were killed, and there should be some examination, a thorough examination, into who the victims are. That's one of the major concerns that we had in this report and one of the issues which needs significant response and attention as soon as possible from the administration. But even without that mischaracterization of those who have been targeted, there is plenty of information, and we went through all the information in media sources and in what are called data aggregators, and there are three major data aggregators. And even the most conservative data aggregators, with whom we have significant issues because of their undercounting, even they are talking about scores and scores, if not hundreds and hundreds of civilians. And the most reliable data aggregator has calculated up to as many as 800, nearly 900 civilians killed. So the single digits narrative is fantasy. And it's highly problematic because what it does is it allows most people in the United States to accept the false narrative of surgically precise, terrorist-only weapons, almost as though these weapons were able to go down to a house level, knock on the door, establish that the person is a terrorist by overwhelming evidence, establish that the person is imminently plotting and about to strike and kill Americans, and then and only then killing the person. That's what it allows people to believe when that's not the case.
Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford. And Jim and the clinic there are one of the co-authors of a new report on drone warfare in Pakistan called Living Under Drones. You get a chance, look that up, Living Under Drones. You're never going to be the same after reading it. Now, Jim, one of the things when you're talking about this, the idea that it struck me, especially when I saw this thing, and I'm familiar with the New York Times article you were referring to. And when I saw this thing about they clear up any mistakes posthumously. I mean, one, I think you're right. you would think that they would make that clarification, make that decision before they killed somebody. But even there's a certain cynicism and a real deep, disgusting, unreal thing in there, because posthumously, after being hit by a drone, is a pretty gruesome affair from what I understand in your report. It seems like that's actually almost a given that that's not going to happen.
Well, let me put it this way, because we can't know everything, and there's so much secrecy surrounding the U.S. drone practices. Virtually everything is shrouded, unfortunately, in an inappropriate secrecy, and evidently there's some margin that we understand for national security that might be legitimately invoked, but it's been used to cover everything related to the drone program, including its very existence. But again, what we know from the way drones work is those who are very close to the blast radius are incinerated. So it would be highly difficult, at a minimum, to establish information about those victims. But what I can say is we are unaware of any serious, comprehensive effort by the United States to find out almost anything about those who are struck by drones. And we also are aware of the fact that in many instances, authorities have been unable even to identify those who have been killed, much less to establish who the person was, what the person was doing, if the person was a combatant, etc. So yes, you're right. There's very little to suggest that there is any significant attempt posthumously to exonerate those who have been killed, which leaves you with, if you were killed, you were a combatant. And then if you roll that backwards, what does that do, that knowledge that drone operators and administrators and administration authorities have, that if they make a mistake or if they target the wrong people, there's unlikely to be any consequence? What does that do to their targeting decision and their willingness to fire drones? I don't know, but it's a question that concerns me.
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing you guys raised in the report that really, really sort of just smacked me in the head is the point that they often describe, and you see this in the press all the time, they describe the victims of, or the targets, because they don't really ever talk about victims of, they talk about the targets of the drone attacks are all militants, which is a phrase you actually call for at the end of your report. You guys call for actually stop using the term militants so easily and start trying to define people as what they are, because militants does seem to be a word that's been thrown around to obfuscate everything that's really going on there. What's the story with that?
Yeah, it is. And I don't want to head too far into the realm of legalese, but militant is a term that sounds as though it legitimates or justifies the killing of the person. So that if a person is a militant, then that person could be killed by a drone. And that's not the case under international law. In order for a target to be legitimate under international humanitarian law, the laws of war, the person would not only have to be a combatant, but the person would have to be engaged in an activity that imminently threatens interests that the United States could protect, like, say, U.S. lives or interests in Afghanistan across the border, and there would have to be no means of capturing that person. So a person could be a militant or a combatant, not be posing a threat to U.S. interests, and or be subject to capture. And if any of those are the case, in other words, if the person is not presenting a threat to the United States, or if the person could be captured, then that person should not be killed by a drone strike, or could not or should not legally. So that's one issue, which is very important, is who can the United States kill or might it be able to kill legally, and who can it not kill? But secondarily, and this is in many ways the bigger issue, what we've seen in the mainstream media is that the reporting on drone strikes in an area known as Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, which is an area of extremely difficult access because of the terrain, but also because it's cordoned off by the Pakistani military, it's an area in which you simply can't enter. And what media sources have done is report, in effect, verbatim information from anonymous security officials about who was killed. So anonymous security officials who evidently have an interest in saying that those who they killed were combatants, as opposed to, hey, we killed a bunch of civilians today, they tell the media anonymously what they want the media to print, and the media then obediently, unfortunately, in many, many instances, has simply printed what they are asked to print by anonymous sources. We don't think that that's an appropriate role for an aggressive democratic media. And one of the things that we call on is for journalists to speak more critically about who are their sources and also to interrogate what they're saying. So that if the only source for the assertion that all of those who were killed are militants is an anonymous security official, maybe if you're a journalist, you say, we don't know who they are. They're people. They're men. Some people or some anonymous sources said they were militants, as opposed to militant, 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 militant throughout the article. So there is some responsibility here on the part of the media.
Tell me this, Jim. How does this add up when you throw in something that was, again, and I keep saying, it keeps, as you read the report, you keep getting more and more outraged. The idea of double tapping. Can you explain to my listeners what double tapping is and what that says about this, the civilian targeting?
So double tapping refers to a practice where a drone will fire a Hellfire missile, a first strike, and then shortly afterwards fire a second strike. And there have been a significant number of cases where this has been documented to have occurred in Pakistan. What that means in practice is there's a missile strike. It hits a target. It has a blast radius. There may be a number of people who are killed or maimed or injured in the blast radius. And now what's happened is when others, first responders, have gone in to assist those who are injured and may still be alive, a second strike kills them. And because that has happened so frequently, unfortunately, in an area known as North Waziristan, which is the epicenter of these strikes, the people with whom we spoke, and we spoke with 70 people from that area who had been directly affected by drone strikes, they told us that they won't go into an area where a drone has struck because they're afraid that they'll be the victim of a second strike. And we had some really gruesome testimony of people who were near enough to strikes to see victims, and the victims are screaming, and people won't go in to help them because they're afraid they'll be hit by another strike. But there's an important point here, Michael, which if I could elaborate here, is the nature of the drone strikes, double tapping, as it's called, is one phenomenon, is such that because people don't know when drones are going to strike, all sorts of ordinary activities have been affected in these areas. And people are suffering from significant psychological trauma, according to the symptoms that they described to us, and also according to the interviews that we did with mental health professionals who have treated people from that area.
I want to get into that in just a second, but I want to remind listeners that we're talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law and the founding director of Stanford Law School's International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And that clinic is one of the co-authors, along with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, of a brand new study that's really worth you going out, finding the study, reading it, and thinking a whole hell of a lot on it. And then think about what you're going to do after you read that and understand what's going on. And the study is called Living Under Drones. Now, Jim, you started to talk about that, the Living Under Drones. What's the impact on this? I mean, as I understood, one of the things that blew my mind, and I think there was somebody who was part of your team or part of the I can't remember whether it was with Stanford or NYU, Jennifer Gibson, I think her name was.
Jennifer Gibson was part of our research team
at
Stanford, and then graduated and has now working with an organization based in London.
Right. Well, she wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times where she talked about how so many of us think that a drone strike is like sort of, it comes in, the drone comes in, one or two of them come in, just appear out of nowhere, and that they fire a single missile or two missiles or whatever into a crowd of people, and then they disappear. She said, actually, you're talking about a situation where 24/7 people are living under the threat of drones, literally. Is that the case?
Well, so here's what we were able to document. You know, I went to Pakistan twice for a couple of weeks and spent time speaking with, again, this group of 70 people who in several trips came and met with us who live in areas where drones fly overhead and who were directly affected because some of them themselves had been injured or maimed by drone strikes, or they'd lost a relative or many relatives, or because they'd had drones hovering over and edged fire down Hellfire missiles in their communities. So these are people who are living constantly under drones. And what they told us, and this was really probably what really had the greatest impact on us, as much as the death and destruction and maiming evidently has an impact on anyone, what they told us is the drones in their communities hover overhead at times 24 hours a day for several days on end. They emit a buzzing sound. And we spoke with many, many people, and they would imitate the sound like a bee. It's something that even when they're sleeping, it's there and it's in the back of their heads. And they have no idea when one of these drones will fire a Hellfire missile down on their communities. They also don't know where it will hit or who it will hit. So imagine what this does to them on a daily basis. They're walking in the bazaar. They don't want to get too close to someone if they don't know who that person is, because maybe that person is suspected of being a combatant by the drone operator, and maybe a drone will hit that person. And if it does, and if I'm within 15 or 20 yards, I will be killed by the shrapnel. So that's the logic, and what it's done is it's cast a pall on all sorts of activities. People told us, for instance, they don't go out of their houses unless they have to. They don't congregate with three or four men anymore. They don't go to religious services. They don't go to funerals. And here's the maybe the worst is many people told us they don't send their children to school anymore because they don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going to be. They don't know if they're going to wander into an area where there's a group of men that might look to someone in, say, Nevada who's watching a video image like a group of militants or combatants. So the entire community has been profoundly affected. And the other major effect, evidently related to the first, are the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms of other psychological maladies, of stress-related disorders that many people with whom we spoke told us about their suffering themselves and of many others in their community suffering. And I would say in a short sentence, the United States has not declared war on Pakistan and is not officially engaged in a war in North Waziristan. But the narratives of the people in that area were narratives that sounded like people living in a war zone. That's the way the people living under drones experience drones and drone strikes.
You know, Jim, I want to, and let me remind listeners again, we're talking with Jim Cavallaro from Stanford, and he's one of the co-authors of a new study called Living Under Drones. Jim, tell me this. We're running up on our time, so I want to make sure we get a chance to speak to this. And I know you were careful not to get into all the legalese and legalisms in terms of language before, but a significant part of your study actually does raise the question of the legality or illegality of all this. And that really strikes me because I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, how many crimes are going to be allowed to be committed? And to me, it really, from my own viewpoint, after reading your study and my own thinking about it beforehand, these kinds of things, at the very least, must violate half a dozen international law. You know, it just seems to me humanitarian law has to be violated time and time again in the process of this whole drone warfare system. What did you guys find about that?
So I'll try and be succinct, but let me start by saying there is significant evidence, and we've pulled it together in this report, and there are other sources as well that demonstrate that there is every likelihood that many, many drone strikes have occurred in violation of international law. But here's what makes it tricky, and this is part of, I would say, the strategy, although I can't speak to knowingly what the strategy of the administration is, but it seems as though this may be what they've been thinking. You can imagine a hypothetical scenario, one can imagine, where there is a person in North Waziristan, a combatant, and the combatant is about to fire a missile, and the missile will strike and kill, I don't know how many Americans in Afghanistan, hypothetically, okay? And there's no way to arrest this person, and the person has the missile and is about to fire it and is about to strike it. And in that circumstance, one can imagine, well, it might be legal under those circumstances as described for the U.S. or someone to use some sort of lethal military strike, such as a drone, to attack that person before the person who is about to imminently attack and kill many Americans can fire the missile he's about to fire, right? So you can imagine, you can work into the intellectual possibility of that occurring. Here's what happens. because that intellectual possibility occurs, and because the United States has taken measures to close off investigations, to shroud drone strikes in secrecy, to unfortunately to make sure that media do not know what's happening, the administration is able to say, our strikes are legal. We won't provide any basis for why that's true. We won't let you know what the legal memoranda say. We won't let you know the specifics of what happened in any of these cases. But because there's some theoretical, hypothetical possibility that maybe there could be a legally valid drone strike, we're just going to tell you they're legal. Now go away, stop investigating, and report what I tell you. That's what we've gotten. And that simply is not good enough in a democracy. It's not good enough with a media that should be concerned about human life, and it's not good enough with a society of citizens who should be concerned about human life anywhere, not just in the United States, but human life in Pakistan. And it should also concern us when we know that 176 children, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, have been killed by drone strikes in Pakistan, and as many as 880 civilians. So there are very, very serious legal questions that need to be answered, and I don't think they're going to be answered until people get outraged and demand those answers from authorities.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, though. It's one thing for people to think about people doing that, and it's to me, it's really important, because here you look at it, and you guys make a point in your study that since Obama came into office, the number of drone strikes and the devastation caused by drones has just increased immensely in 3 years. I mean, it's
much... five or sixfold, yeah, by
yeah.
five or six times, exactly.
Yeah. And people keep turning away and turning a blind eye to this. And I was thinking, even these things of, like you were talking about those things that he talked about in terms of a personality strike in a certain sense. If you're going after one person and you think they got this, and while that's bad enough, he also has instituted these things called signature strikes, which to me, just by the very description of them, the character of them, Jesus, that's that. You know, what are we thinking that we could sit and say, okay, this makes sense to me? Tell people what a signature strike is, and what do you think about that?
You're absolutely right. What's most worrisome about the drone practices of the United States are the signature strikes. So let's just go through what the difference is. A personality strike is one where an individual has been identified. The United States military or CIA authorities know who the person is. They have reason to know that the person is involved in Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and is plotting an incident imminently, represents a threat, can't be arrested, all of that criteria that would have to be filled, and they decide to target that person. Let's put that to the side. And we should put that to the side because all evidence suggests that that kind of strike, a personality strike, is a small percentage of the strikes that have taken place, particularly in recent years. Where most strikes occur is in what's called the signature strike context. And what does that mean? It means that people who are watching the videos, the images taken by drones, they're watching those images, God knows where, possibly at some CIA location, undisclosed location in the United States, in Nevada, elsewhere. They're watching those images, and they assess from those images, based on the pattern of activity, that the people that they're looking at are combatants, that those people are plotting or engaged imminently in an attack on U.S. interests, and that they can't be captured. At least that's what they're telling us. And when they establish all that from the video screen, then they fire one Hellfire missile and maybe a second when first responders come to kill those people. That's almost certainly where most of the deaths have occurred. And that is far beyond where a lot of the focus of the media has been in recent months, particularly since the New York Times article that we referred to earlier by Joe Becker and Scott Shane, which talked about Obama's role in making decisions about the first kind of strike, the personality strikes, where the individual who is targeted is known. The focus has been on personality strikes, even though most of the deaths almost certainly have occurred in signature strikes, where someone is looking at a video image and deciding, oh, these people, they're probably up to no good. They're probably doing something that will have lethal consequences for the United States. We don't think we'll arrest them, so we'll kill them. That is a context which, again, I think should raise all sorts of red flags.
Absolutely. And Jim, one last thing, just so people can have this on their minds as they go about their business after hearing this interview, the numbers. What are the numbers involved?
Well, the numbers of people killed?
Yes.
Well, we're looking at, you know, unfortunately, several thousand now in Pakistan. And again, there are others in Yemen, but that wasn't the focus of our report. But the numbers, the best source, which is the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, had the numbers through September, through early September, at between 2,562 and 3,325 people, of whom they were able to classify, with all of the ambiguity in the information, between 474 and 881 as civilians and 176 as children. And again, many more of those could be civilians, but there's not enough information to know that. So, you know, significant numbers. If you look at the numbers of people killed, it's on the order of people who were killed in 9/11.
All right, Jim, we're going to have to wrap this up now. But before we go, where can people find the study?
The site is livingunderdronesalltogether.org. And there they can find the study. There's a video. There's all sorts of resources relevant to this issue. And hopefully, one thing I'll say is this is an issue where, again, to the extent people are involved in outrage and let people in Congress and the administration and others know, you know, that might start some sort of some process of accountability within the United States.
All right, Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michael. Sure. I appreciate it.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Jim Cavallaro from the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And Jim and the clinic, together with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, are the co-authors of a new report called Living Under Drones. And it's just a compelling, horrifying, and enraging report. So check that one out. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. And I want to remind you as we go out that the front part of today's show and for the last couple of weeks, I have been running parts of an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And this interview is a 5-part interview. So far, we've aired 3 parts of the interview, including the one that we did today. If you miss any part of this interview or you just want to go back and listen to it again, you can access it by going to the site for Revolution Newspaper, and that's revcom.us. revcom.us, all right? And that's the site for Revolution Newspaper. You'll be able to pick up all the segments that have run so far, and when the interview is over, you'll be able to access the entire interview. So stay with us. This is an extremely important historic interview, all right? I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, and my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, do it quietly and unobtrusively by following me on Twitter and Facebook, all right? We're going to go out now with a little bit more from the Slackers called War Criminals, and just because it seems so damn appropriate after listening to this report on drones, all right? Talk to you again next week.
International war criminal. Information is minimal. Weapons of destruction, they are gasoline and petroleum. Crawling on his brown skin, but ain't it shameful just